This is KYUK Public Radio for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. I'm Evan Erickson. As of Thursday morning, communities were tallying up damage from a severe Bering Sea storm that brought flood warnings to a vast swath of Alaska's western coast, leading to evacuations in the northwest communities of Kotzebue and Kivalina. But further south along the Yukon Delta coast, minimal damage was reported the morning after the storm. In Hooper Bay, waters that inundated low-lying areas in the community had receded as of Thursday morning. The community's public safety office confirmed that no damage had resulted from the flooding. A receptionist at the community's school confirmed that no families ultimately needed to use the school as an overnight shelter after the city and tribe offered up use of the space on Wednesday afternoon. Nearby in Scammon Bay, waters had reportedly receded as of Thursday morning and no property damage was reported. A village public safety officer confirmed that several boats had been swamped by high water. On Wednesday night, waters temporarily inundated the lower parts of the community and the road that accesses the airport. Further north in Kotlik, photos posted to social media on Wednesday night showed water surrounding all of the homes in the community. This morning, the community's public safety office confirmed that water had mostly drained out from the community, scattering debris around the area, but not causing any damage. Finally, in Nunam Iqua, where the National Weather Service expected some of the worst effects of the storm, no damage was reported. The community's tribal office confirmed Thursday morning that waters had completely receded after inundating the community for roughly 6 hours the prior evening. Now, these same Yukon Delta coastal communities are bracing for another, potentially much more powerful storm, the remnants of Typhoon Halong. A high wind watch has been issued for the region from late Saturday evening through late Sunday night, with wind gusts of 60 miles per hour or more expected. The National Weather Service says flood watches will likely be issued soon as well. Stay tuned to KYUK 640 AM or visit kyuk.org for storm updates as they become available. And now to look at another potential threat coming out of the Bering Sea. Western Alaska is bracing for another strong storm system this weekend as the remnants of Typhoon Halong are expected to move into the Bering Sea late Sunday into Monday. Forecasters with the National Weather Service say communities across the region could see strong winds, high surf, and coastal flooding. KNOM's Ben Townsend reports.
Typhoon Halong is currently off the coast of Japan, but according to National Weather Service meteorologist Carter McKay, the typhoon is expected to move east before turning north toward the Bering Sea.
The confidence is high that it will work, you know, north into the Bering, but exactly the track of where it goes once it gets to the Aleutians is a bit more uncertain. That main track and how intense it gets, how strong the storm ends up developing, are the two main things we're looking at.
McKay says models currently predict the tides will drop several feet below normal before surging back up as the system passes through the Bering Strait.
It actually shows water receding to like 2 to 6 feet below the low tide line. So it's drawing out a lot of water from our coastal communities, only then to pretty much a day later bring it all back with the winds.
The weekend's potential storm is reminiscent of 2022's ex-typhoon Murbach, which caused millions of dollars in damage across western Alaska. But McKay says it's too early to accurately compare the two storms.
You know, the track is certainly going to be different than the one that Murbach took. And this far out, it's pretty tough to tell the exact where the low is going to be, you know, tracking up through the Bering. But it does carry similarities in terms of the potential impacts that we could see.
Rick Toman is a climatologist with the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Preparedness. He says the region has been hit with several big storms this week, and he's also watching this next one.
To have another one come along seems like it's worth starting to get folks thinking about, okay, what if we have another big storm over the weekend, given that we have a significant storm right now?
NOAA officials met Wednesday morning to discuss the ongoing and upcoming storms. Emergency shelters and supplies will be made available in case of extreme flooding. The city is encouraging the community to build emergency kits with water, warm clothes, and food in case evacuation is necessary. Residents can also find the latest forecast by visiting weather.gov/AFG. In Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
Funding for a program subsidizing rural air travel is set to continue through early November despite the ongoing government shutdown. That's according to a notice the U.S. Transportation Department sent to airlines on Wednesday afternoon. And it's an update from earlier this week when U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy warned that the Essential Air Service program could run out of money as soon as Sunday. The subsidies are meant to ensure small communities have access to air travel, even if commercial flights aren't necessarily profitable. The program subsidizes routes to 65 Alaska communities, most of which are not connected to the road system. The extension is a relief, says Alaska Air Carriers Association head Will Day.
That's hopeful. From an industry perspective, it gives time for the government to, you know, to recover and appropriate those funds. So right now, I would say, generally speaking, we're cautiously hopeful that funding will be restored before November 2nd and things continue and business continues as usual.
Even if funding does run out, some airlines serving Alaska communities say they're not expecting disruptions, at least in the short term. But Day says the impacts of a lapse would be uneven, and smaller airlines would face an especially difficult path forward. Day says a small carrier serving the Kuskokwim River community of McGrath would be forced to nearly quadruple its fares for a one-way flight to or from Anchorage. Alaska Airlines told Alaska Public Media they expected to continue flying even if funding ran out. It's a similar story in Kodiak for Island Air Service. Here's Island Air co-owner Eric Howard.
We're going to do our best to just kind of keep providing service to the Essential Air Service communities as best we can, be uninterrupted, and hope that the government figures it out. But if it does go more than a month, then we might have to reevaluate and see from there.
The state's second largest Essential Air Service carrier, Grant Aviation, says it's working with the congressional delegation to keep the program funded, but the company wouldn't say whether it expected disruptions if funding did lapse. Democrats and Republicans each blame each other for the shutdown, and it shows little sign of resolving anytime soon. Indigenous peoples in the Arctic have been using underground food storage for thousands of years, but the practice is changing as the environment warms. Researchers have been looking at how villages in Alaska and Arctic communities in other countries are reimagining the future of ice cellars. The Alaska Desk's Alonia Nyden has more.
Several wooden boxes poke up above ground along the coast in Savunga on St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea. They are a few feet deep and are now empty. But traditionally, they are filled with walrus, reindeer, and whale meat to keep the harvest cool. Ice cellars, or sikluaks in Yupik, are common throughout Alaska Native communities. But the Arctic has been warming almost four times faster than other parts of the world. Researchers from the University of Alaska Fairbanks have been studying how food preservation practices have been changing. Last month, they visited St. Lawrence Island to discuss their findings. Yoko Kugo is originally from Japan and is one of the researchers with the UAF Center of Cross-Cultural Studies who is leading the project.
We heard that some communities, not all of them, but some are having a hard time rely on storing food underground.
For the past 3 years, Kugo and other URIF researchers have been visiting the communities of Savunga and Gamble on St. Lawrence Island, as well as Anaktuvik Pass and Point Hope on the North Slope. They learned how food preservation practices vary depending on local landscape and diets. And they heard from residents that permafrost thaw and erosion have been causing some of their ice cellars to collapse or flood. Despite the challenges, many continue using ice cellars and hope to preserve the practice. Another UIF researcher, Michael Koski, has been working on the project as well. He says that while the climate is expected to get hotter throughout the century, underground, the temperatures should fluctuate less. He says that might be a solution for residents who want to continue using ice cellars.
If they're willing to go a little deeper and a little further inland, there's more of a chance of making a new cellar and maintaining those traditions.
The project, funded through the National Science Foundation, is a part of a larger effort to understand how Indigenous people in the Arctic and subarctic have been adapting to climate change. Kugo and Koski have been working with researchers who are doing similar work in Russia, Mongolia, and Japan. They say that in other countries, people are making use of ice cellars too. In Japan, it is more about preserving traditions, And in some communities in Russia and Mongolia, people need ice cellars to keep food and drinking water cold.
I think in all of these places, to some degree, there's a hold on to it because it's a tradition of the past. You know, it's an identity thing.
During the most recent meeting in Savunga, residents asked researchers about climate predictions and stressed the resilience of indigenous people in face of environmental change. Elder John Wahagi says that Savunga hunters continue to harvest marine mammals, and the warming is not detrimental to their way of life. He says walrus is one example.
They're still very fat, healthy. Polar bears are fat, they're healthy. We still very actively harvest the marine mammal resources.
Kuga with UIF says that overall, residents in four Alaska communities asked them about practical takeaways from their research, like techniques and materials to repair ice cellars or to build community underground storage. She says there was also interest in exchanging knowledge with people from across the Arctic and subarctic.
This project might be a bridge between the communities. They are looking for what they can do and do together.
While researchers are nearing the end of the social science part of the project, climate evaluations are continuing. Collaborations with other countries will go on as well. At the end of October, Kugo plans to present the project at the International Symposium on Arctic Research in Tokyo. She hopes to talk more with researchers from Japan, Mongolia, and Siberia there as well. In Anchorage, I am Alena Naidin.
This is KYUK News. I'm Evan Erickson. Kuyana for listening. Please share your news tips, comments, or suggestions. You can email us at news@kyuk.org or message us on Facebook. And stay tuned for Yoktun Ganumchit. Coming up.